Devinder, we're so grateful that you've taken time in your hectic schedule to come and stop at ITG and talk to us about important issues on GM crops and trade, biotechnology, of course, this is the International Year of Rice. And so I wondered if we could talk about a number of these issues and to get the benefit of your wisdom and perspective, particularly from India, on what's going on at the World Trade Organization, particularly in context of the Doha Development Round and what happened in Cancun, where India took a very strong position. How do you see that shaping up? What's going to be the developments? And what does civil society and farmers organizations in India think about this?
Thank you, Patrick. And it's been my privilege, I would say, to be at ITDG finally and to be with you and, of course, your wonderful team. When you talk of trade, I think what is important, as I'm sure you'll agree with me, is that we look at it from a perspective that what is exactly happening today and why are they driving this trade agenda to ensure that, you know, the world opens up for agriculture. Today there are two blocks, mainly the European Union and the and North America, actually overladen with food gains. Not today now, but if you look at 5 years, 5 years backwards, they were overladen with food stocks and so on. So they desperately wanted a market for their produce. So therefore, agriculture was woven into the trade regime. And also in the name of, you know, helping the poor countries, the hungry for development and so on, trade will give them an opportunity to export their products to this part of the world. And so which means the incomes will rise, the prices will rise, so therefore the incomes will rise and so on. But unfortunately, what has happened, as we all know, is that the three pillars of the agreement on agriculture, the market access, the domestic support, as well as export subsidies. The idea was that you remove the bottlenecks so that trade becomes much more free. But in reality, what has happened is that all these three pillars, you know, the promises that were made around these three pillars, nothing has come true as far as the rich countries were concerned. So all the expectations that have, that, you know, developing countries were made to believe have actually come blank. And whereas the developing countries have opened up their trade barriers, we have been asked to remove our quantitative restrictions, or if you didn't have QRs, you had the other trade mechanisms that have also been phased out. So developing countries have become a dumping ground. So we become an open field. So cheaper import is coming into our countries. It's not only India. If you look at India, Pakistan, look at Jamaica, or look at Brazil, or in Argentina, or all over the world, countries are now becoming importing countries. You know, the net food exporting countries, or the countries which were sustainable, or in the sense that they were self-reliant in agriculture, today have become net importing countries. In India alone, since 1995, the food imports have multiplied by 4 times. And these are the crops that we don't need to actually import. But we have a huge surplus of food gain within the country. But now the entire paradigm is that you must import and you must export, of course. So the world has been made to open up, and the trade paradigm is being made to, has been imposed given this feeling that, you know, the world will grow economically, and the farmers need to make income, and so that will come from trade, open trade. But it hasn't happened. It hasn't happened, so after about 7-8 years, we realized that whatever was promised at the Marrakesh Agreement, part of the Marrakesh Agreement, hasn't come true. And when you asked about the G20, the way India has reacted, you know, if you remember at Doha, the so-called development round was introduced. But at the same time in Doha, they promised to phase out their subsidies, make agriculture more, possible for developing countries to export to this part of the world. But in reality, nothing like that happened. And India at Doha was standing up to ensure that, you know, the developing countries are not wiped out in this entire negotiation. And ultimately, the kind of ardent testing that goes on at Doha, India was the only country which was left to stand up and to fight these issues. But at that particular time, we were branded as, India was branded as a country which is a rogue state, which is always creating problems, and which is a country which is isolated now. The world community was for trade, open trade, and so on and so forth. And even developing countries were not siding with India. But if you remember at Cancun, 2 years later, the G1, I would call India as G1, actually became G20. So we had 20 other countries joining us, India, China, and Brazil were the three major giants. plus the other countries. And they opposed the entire agreement on agriculture on the issue of, basically on the issue of agriculture subsidies. Because after all, one part of the world was pumping in more support for agriculture. $360 billion every year was this quantum of subsidies that, you know, 24 rich countries provide to the agriculture. In India, the total output of agriculture is worth $60 billion. This includes milk, this includes fruits and vegetables. So with a $60 billion output and no subsidies, how could we compete with $360 billion? Also, in India, for instance, we have 600 million farmers compared to 7 million farmers you have in European Union, and every fourth farmer in the world is an Indian. And what all we provide to our farmers is $1 billion of subsidies a year, and that's all indirect subsidy. Whereas in this part of the world, you provide $1 billion of support every day. So, and these subsidies were not going down, they were going up. And the political, if you look at the political intention, there is no political concern to bring down these subsidies. They are actually going to protect these subsidies. The special safeguard measures that they provide to developing countries have actually gone on to protect the rich countries. So the rich countries want to protect the agriculture, and they want the rest of the world to become their market. So that, I suppose, was the biggest problem which is confronting the agriculture negotiations. It is not based on sustainable agriculture and so on. It's basically the politics that has to be understood when we talk of agriculture.
Thank you. Is it worth having a quick review of how that came over? Because he's looking partly here, partly there. Does it look okay?
I think it looks okay. Okay.
Thank you. I think that makes it very clear how India is perhaps the staunchest defender of the interests of developing countries. And I would venture to say that in this all this discussion about food sovereignty is the one that probably stands up most for local determination, the kind of food system you require. But it gets worse, doesn't it? Because with the development of new technologies, particularly biotechnologies, and the development of genetic engineering, we're finding in country after country, and I'm sure it's the same in India, the imposition of genetically engineered crops, genetic engineered livestock, into the production system, mostly against the wishes of farmers. But maybe you could just explain what the view is from India to the assertion that is made by the President of the United States, George W. Bush, who says that GM crops are necessary to feed the world.
If you look at it, Patrick, I think this is part of the same global agenda. And the global packet, if you see, is comprising the World Bank, IMF, WTO, and of course the GM crops. We are being told that there are 840 million people who go to bed hungry every night, and their number will swell to 1.5 billion by the year 2015. So therefore you need to produce more, and so therefore you need genetically modified crops. That's one of the arguments. But if you look at the total quantity of food that we produce today in the world, for about 6 billion people, if we were to distribute that food judiciously according to WHO norms, you know, which is 2,400 calories for the rural areas, or let's say 2,800 or 3,000 calories for the urban areas, we would have food still left for 800 million people, which means there is no dearth of food in the world. It's only that one part of the world is eating more and the other part of the world is being underfed. And I think again a comparison would be very interesting. In America, 62% of the population is obese. In India, 62% of the population is underfed. In America, there are more weight reduction clinics than there are ration shops in India. Now, with these kinds of inequalities, you know, we have been told that, you know, we need to produce more, and so therefore we need genetically modified crops. But at the same time, it's very interesting that out of these 840 million people who go to bed hungry every night, roughly 320 million people, or one third, live in India. And normally we would tend to believe that it's because India doesn't produce more food, we are deficient in food gains and so on, but the reality is that India is overladen with food stocks. You know, if you look at the situation from the turn of the century, in 2001 and 2002 we had a mountain of surplus, which is 65 million tons of wheat and rice. Now, it doesn't give you a clear picture. When you say 65 million tons or 95 million tons, you know, people don't get to know how much was their quantity. So let's put it like this. If you just stack one bag of wheat over another bag, and the 65 million tons would mean that you could walk up to moon and come back. So that was the quantity of food lying in India, and we had 320 million people going to bed hungry. Now, if 65 million tons could not feed the hungry, how will genetically modified food feed the hungry? But when we talk of the hunger, we are always being told, no, we need to produce more, so therefore you need GM crops. Also, the industry has begun to realize that, you know, this argument is not going far. So they have moved on to another wonderful, or let's say, illusion that they create. And this time it is hidden hunger. First it was hunger, now it is hidden hunger. They are saying that hunger is prevalent, but what more and more people die because of micronutrient deficiency, you know, the vitamin A deficiency or iron deficiency and so on and so forth. So therefore, genetically modified crops provide an opportunity to produce novel foods, functional foods, which meet your nutrient requirements. So therefore, you address the problem of hidden hunger. We have had in recent past, one of the wonderful magic bullets that the industry has developed is genetically modified rice, which contains vitamin A component in it. The gene drawn from daffodil into for beta carotene and put into rice. And we are being told that 68 million people worldwide suffer from vitamin A deficiency. So, and many of them die, so therefore you need vitamin A rice. But in reality, out of the 68 million people, 12 million live in India. Now I can tell you about India. In India, all these 12 million people are living in a belt which is called as the hunger belt of India. Which would extend from western parts of Odisha to Bihar. These are the areas which are not deficient food, but these are the areas where people do not have the purchasing power to buy their food. Now, if you look at Odisha, Odisha is very interesting. There is an area called as Kalahandi in Odisha. It is infamous for its hunger and starvation. Every time you hear about Kalahandi, it's always about hunger. So many people have died of hunger and so on. But what is relatively less known is that Kalahandi is the biggest producer of rice, surplus rice, in Odisha for the central kitty. Year after year, they produce a surplus of rice, which is almost, if you look at it, average 50,000 tons they produce of rice surplus year after year. And yet people can't buy that rice. Now please tell me, if people can't buy the normal rice, how will they buy the golden rice? And then the industry says that, you know, we provide novel foods and functional foods, we provide people choices. Given a choice, I'm sure you'll agree, all that the people need is food, which is lying in front of their eyes. Now, if they can't access that food, how do you think they will access genetically modified food? But at the same time, we are being told, no, you know, you people are opposed to poor being fed and so on. And so, you know, this is the kind of food that will meet their requirement. But also at the same time, nutritionists tell us that if you have to absorb these macronutrients into your body, you need adequate body fat. And in one community or class of people where this fat is conspicuously absent are the hungry. So if they have no body fat, how will they absorb these nutrients that have to that we are supplying, or biofortification and so on and so forth? In the recent past, we also had another wonderful magic bullet being developed by the technology. It's wonderful, quote unquote. It talks of GM potato now. And they say they moved the gene from amaranthus into a potato. And they claim that this GM potato will contain 40% more protein than the average. And when this news was flashed around, the entire global media went gaga over this news. And it's very interesting to see, and it is also branded as, you know, a product which, because potato is something which is part of daily Indian diet, it's also very cheap, people can afford it, so therefore now you have an answer which will remove malnutrition in India, because India has the largest population of malnourished in the world. But interestingly, GM potato, as said earlier, you know, it contains 40% more protein than the average. Now, what is the average? On an average, potato contains 1.6% protein. If you jack it up by 40%, it means it will come to about 2% or 2.3% of protein. With 2.3%, let us take the extreme value. If with 2.3% protein, they want to eradicate micronutrient deficiency in India. On the other hand, as I said earlier, we had in India 65 million tons of wheat and rice stacked in open. The average protein content in wheat and rice was 9%. if we, and this is four times what the GM potato contained, but no scientist and the industry ever talked of distributing that 65 million tons for the poor. It could have eradicated micronutrient deficiency as well as hunger, but we didn't do it. So the industry's interest is very clear. As long as as long as it brings profit to the corporation, then everybody is supporting the issue of hunger or eradicating hunger or hidden hunger. But if the process of eradicating hunger or the effort that we make to eradicate hunger doesn't bring profit to the GM companies, scientists are not interested. Then the hungry should go to hell. Again, I'll illustrate from another point. In 2001-2002, when we had a mountain of surplus in India, in America, one company, Aventis Corporation, they had developed genetically modified rice. And the US Food and Drug Administration had actually asked them to destroy that rice because still in the experimental stages. The total quantity of that GM rice was about 3,000 tons. 2,000 scientists, including several Nobel laureates, signed an appeal saying that this rice should not be destroyed. It should go to feed the hungry in Africa or in other parts of the world. And this appeal was circulated. The FDA was requested to at least reconsider its decision. At that particular time, I made a counter appeal, Patrick, that if you are interested, you are worried about 3,000 tons of genetically modified rice. We have 65 million tons of wheat and rice, which is non-genetically modified, lying with us in India. Please come and join us in the fight against hunger. And believe me, not even one of the scientists responded. It's a clear indication that scientists' interest is not towards eradicating hunger, but to ensure that the company's profits are secured. And in this entire process, as we know, biotechnology brings in external aided crops, and of course it brings in coming with the stronger intellectual property rights. It will deprive the people of their control over seed and all those kinds of the problem that will erupt in a cycle are going to happen. So therefore there is a huge crisis coming up from genetically modified crops for developing countries.
You put the case very clearly, and I do hope that our own government listens carefully to it, particularly our Department for International Development, that continues to promote the case for genetically modified crops, relying on very specious data from, for example, the Nuffield Council for Bioethics, and I note the response you made to their recently released report. In which they said there was a moral case to work on this. I think you've dismissed that very, very adequately. But you raised at the end of that discussion the issue of intellectual property rights. This week, on Wednesday, the 31st of March, quite a historic event in Rome, where the International Treaty on Plant Genetic Resources for Food and Agriculture, the International Seed Treaty, will have its 40th ratification deposited, in fact, by the UK, and will come into force, the treaty will come into force in July. Now, in this treaty, it says in one particular article, Article 12 Treaty, that recipients of these resources may not claim intellectual property rights on those resources. It goes on and gets a bit muddled about it later. But I think you make a very clear case in your last answer that these intellectual property rights are fueling the biotech revolution, they're fueling genetic engineering, and they're preventing access by farmers to the seeds they require to grow the food that they need. I just wonder, can you reflect on the importance of keeping intellectual property rights away from agricultural seeds and the importance of the treaty?
I think you're very right. IPR is one of the very contentious issues, and hats off to you, Patrick, for bringing that in public limelight, or let's say keeping that in public domain. I mean, your single contribution, I think, is much more significant than all that has gone around on this issue. Having said that, you will agree, when we had the Green Revolution coming in the late 60s, that was the time when the high-yielding varieties were developed. And these varieties, let's accept it, did the magic, and especially in Asia and parts of Africa and Latin America, it raised production. When we went in for Green Revolution in India, we imported 18,000 tons of wheat, dwarf wheat, from Mexico. as part of seed consignment. If we were today to buy the same 18,000 tons of seed which comes with IPR regime, there would have been no green revolution. That itself is an indication that how dangerous the IPR regime is. Now, those varieties which came from the CGIAR system in India or in other parts of the world, in Asia and Latin America and so on, were devoid of IPR controls. And what happened was the research infrastructure of countries like India or China or other Asian countries was able to involve or inculcate or take advantage of the varietal developments and incorporate those characters in their future breeding programs. In India, we now have about 2,400 varieties developed after the Green Revolution period. Only 1% of it was developed by the private companies. 99% of these varieties were evolved by the public infrastructure. And if those varieties could do the magic in India, could put India from a ship-to-mouth existence into the comfortable position of self-reliant as far as agriculture is concerned, there is no reason why we need to dismantle that and have faith on IPR regime. But this happened because the public research infrastructure in India was capable of seeing the realities, the need of the country, and then develop varieties suitably. They also encouraged farmers to go on with their breeding as the farmers would do. Farmers own bred varieties. And the system prevailed in India. But today we are being told that, you know, this is something which is inefficient. So you need to rely more on IPR regime, which of course the control is with the private companies. On the issue that you have been fighting for long, a country like India has traditionally never had patents on agriculture. But in this part of the world, there was patents on agriculture. Let me also illustrate by what it can do or how it can be damaging. When we got the rice varieties from Philippines, from the International Rice Institute, we got the wheat varieties from CIMMYT in Mexico City. There was one variety which was developed in America. It was the single cross hybrid of maize. Now that variety was under utility patent in America. And India had requested America to give India that variety. Americans never gave us that variety. That single variety was responsible for bringing the maize revolution in America. The maize production that we talk about in America today is basically the outcome of that single cross hybrid varieties that were developed in America. But that technology was not given to us. It was a patented technology. And because of the patent, we could not benefit. If that that maize variety had come to India, you know, India perhaps would have brought the same revolution that it brought in wheat and rice, also in maize. And sadly, a country which is a huge area under maize in India, maize is still imported in India. It's an indication that we didn't get the right variety because it was under patent control. So that tells us that, you know, what patents can do. It can block development of agriculture. But today we are moving on to a stage when genetic engineering is coming into picture. And genetic engineering, as you know very well, now we are saying that, you know, we need to keep the certified genera, as the seed treaty says, out in the public domain. And rest of the things, of course, we have the right to improve upon them, and the new varieties are, of course, patented. But the genetic makeup or genetic engineering is going to create a still more problem. And I have a feeling that this will make all these seed treaties redundant. And I think we need to wake up to this threat. The threat is very clear. The rice is a staple food which comes from India. It's a crop which originates from India and also from the Japonica region. We are basically the seat of rice. There have been, as some people have said, 200,000 strains of rice available in India about 100, 200 years back, which has now come down to less than 1,000 strains that we grow in India. But in the gene banks, we have almost 160,000 accessions in India. Total accession, out of which I think about 30,000 would be rice strains in India. But when we go in for now research on genetic engineering, companies, as we know, first Monsanto and then Syngenta, they have mapped the rice genome. Rice genome has about 50,000 genes. Now, these companies are now saying that, you know, we are going to look at important genes and draw intellectual property rights over that. And whether the world says that, you know, we are bringing a treaty or not, as we already know, the latest estimate is that over 900 patents on rice genes have already been drawn, majority held by DuPont and then Syngenta. And how will it implicate us? For a country like India, which where the rice has been growing in our backyard for ages now, if we have to go in for GM research or biotechnology research on rice, we cannot do it now because we don't have control over genes. The genes are in the hands of some companies or some institutes outside India. So let me give you one example. India was trying to get a gene for rice because it wanted to go in using biotechnology. And what happened was, we didn't have the control over the gene, and so we went scouting for that particular gene. So this gene was ultimately located in Japan. So we approached that company, the Indian Council of Agriculture approached that company, and finally bought that gene for 3 million rupees. Now that gene was inserted in rice, it didn't work. Now the point here is that, you know, if a country which is the origin of rice today has no control over that rice, so the genes are now being bought from outside, and the public infrastructure has no money for investing so heavily in genes, and that would mean you are actually going to block research. And this, of course, you will agree, will have serious implications for food security of developing countries. And this is a process which has already begun, because product and process patents in agriculture have already come into effect from 2000. So process would mean the biological process, and product, of course, are the genes and cell lines and so on. So these are being patented, which means the developing countries will now be deprived of the advantage that, you know, comes through research. And so it is something which is going to lead towards what I call as scientific apartheid. So it is a scientific apartheid process for against developing countries. And luckily, India and China has a huge public research infrastructure, which has the capacity still to, or maybe it can still overcome this. But what about other developing countries? That's the problem. All developing countries are going to suffer because the research is now getting strangled or in the hands of just one or two companies, or 10, whatever it is, biotechnology companies.
You mentioned that there are some 200,000 varieties of rice 150, 200 years ago in India, and that is now being diminished to maybe 100 or so, of which maybe 10 dominate the rice production in India. Rice, of course, is the most consumed crop in the world, if I understand
right.
It contributes the most to dietary energy.
Yeah.
And indeed, this year, 2004, has been dubbed the International Year of Rice. And I noted that you spoke at the inaugural conference on the Year of Rice, which was held not in India, not in Southeast Asia, but in Switzerland. Maybe you'd like to tell us a bit about the International Year of Rice.
I think it's very relevant to us, to what we are discussing, and the world is celebrating the International Year of the Rice 2004, and this comes 38 years after we had earlier had the International Year of Rice 1966, when we had the first dwarf varieties coming in. Now, at that time, I suppose you will agree it was important to celebrate the Year of Rice, because the rice was always associated with hunger and poverty, and these new varieties, of course, did push up production and so on. Today, we are celebrating the International Year of Rice again. And as you rightly said, the opening ceremony was held at Basel in Switzerland. And rice, as we all know, is a crop which originates from Indica and Japonica regions. That's why it is classified under two categories, Indica and Japonica. And there are, of course, thousands of strains available. But as you rightly mentioned, the last few years, of which few decades, India has 90% of the rice that we grow is, of course, only belongs to 10 varieties. Only 10 varieties are cultivated in 90% of the area. Having said that, we move on to the International Year of Rice. And International Year of Rice at Basel in Switzerland, and when I was asked to deliver this keynote address at this opening ceremony, what I see it as was that perhaps this was a celebration of the emergence of Switzerland on the rice map of the world. Although they don't grow rice, but what is more significant is Basel is the headquarter of the multinational giant Syngenta. And Syngenta, as we all know, has mapped the genome of rice. 93% of mapping has been done by them. So they have the right control over the rice plant now. So therefore, very appropriately, they held the meeting at Basel in Switzerland. And I have a feeling now, and I'm sure you'll agree with me, that rice was traditionally or technically called, as we all know, Oryza Stiva. But with the control coming into in the hands of Syngenta, it is for all practical purposes, the technical name of rice now becomes Oryza Syngenta.
Thank you. very much indeed for providing those very clear explanations of the situation, particularly from the perspective of your expertise in India. I'm greatly looking forward to working with you over for the coming years, and to be able to follow the huge new challenges that exist in terms of trying to ensure that the food system does not get controlled by a few multinational corporations, but indeed remains in the hands of the people. Otherwise, I think the picture you paint of a dystopia in 2015 with 1.5 billion hungry people could well come about. So thank you very much indeed.